Carol, if you could start the recordings and let us know when completed.
Board lines are in.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the IRTP Part D Working Group call on the 14th of April, 2014. On the call today, we have Volker Gremlin, Chris Chaplow, Bartlett Morgan, Barbara Knight, James Liddell, Angie Graves, and Avery Adoria. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Holly Rafe. From staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Marika Konings, Barry Cobb, Natalie Peregrin, Amy Bivens, and myself, Terry Agnew. I'd like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to the IRTPD Working Group call for April 14th. And I was not able to join last week due to a conflict with a registrar and staff call, but I understand that last week may have been canceled. Is that correct, Lars?
Yes, I'm sorry, this is last of the record. Yes, James is correct. Last week we were short in attendance, there's no registrars on the call until we cancel the call.
That makes sense. Thank you, Lars, for confirming. And given the fact that we are still in the midst of an open comment period on our draft report, it is sort of a quiet period for right now until that comment period and reply period closes. So that was probably prudent. So let's work through our agenda. The first item is to ask if anyone has any updates to their statement of interest. If so, please raise your hand in the Adobe room or get my attention on the phone. Okay, hearing none, we'll then ask if anyone has any questions or additions to the proposed agenda, which was circulated earlier this week from Lars and is listed there in the Adobe chat room. Any updates? Okay, then we'll consider that agenda to be adopted and move on to item number two, which is, unfortunately, many of you may have noted that our co-chair, Mike O'Connor, has withdrawn from all ICANN activities. I spoke with Mikey last week, and he assured me it's not he's not in an angry place. He's just you know, spread very thin and overcommitted, like many of us are. And while it's not due to anything, any particular issue, it's just more of a desire on his part to sort of pull back and refocus on things, you know, outside of ICANN. So that raises the question for this particular working group. Are we comfortable going forward with a single chair? If not, do we have any nominations for a replacement co-chair for Mikey? And if that's the case, I would just personally suggest or recommend that that candidate be non-registrars. I think that, you know, we try to balance this particular working group between registrars and non-registrars, but I know that that may be a challenge. I know everyone has a lot on their plate. And then, my only concern is that, I mean, given my track record for travel commitments and other conflicts, I have missed, you know, it hasn't been too much. I would say I probably missed 15-20% of our meetings that we've held so far. So, you know, if we decide not to go forward with another co-chair, then I think that we should get comfortable with more staff-led discussions, like from Lars and Marika. So with that, I'll take a cue, and we'll start with Graham. Go ahead, Graham.
Hey, James. This is Graham Bunton. Just sort of saying that I'm perfectly comfortable, given where we are in this process, moving forward with just a single chair. And I suppose if it does come up that you're unavailable, then this group has been sort of getting smaller and smaller, then maybe we can discuss amongst ourselves who wants to lead the discussion on an ad hoc basis or give that up to staff. That is all.
Thank you, Graham, and an excellent suggestion. And I have actually participated in working groups in the past where exactly that arrangement has been employed. And myself and I think a couple of other folks, Avery, I think you were in that particular group where we would frequently be called upon to act as ad hoc co-chairs. So that is certainly one approach. And I would be happy to continue forward under those circumstances, recognizing that we are Perhaps not near the end, but certainly past the middle of this process, when, you know, depending upon what we receive from public comment, you know, we may just be a few more months left in this particular PVP. So any other thoughts? I thought those were good good contributions from Graham. Anyone else have any strong feelings, any one way or the other? Certainly don't want this to become a peer pressure exercise, although folks and ICANN, and particularly this group, are not shy around each other anymore. So if anyone has any strong opinions, please, let's hear them.
James, Chris Chaplow here.
Chris, please go ahead.
Okay, so I'm not in Adobe. I'm just out and about, so apologies if it's background noise. No, I would concur with that. I don't think we need to have a co-chair, and it sounds quite a good idea going forward. If you can't make it, then to almost take turns on a ad hoc basis. Give other ones of us perhaps a chance to responsibility and the practice to chair a meeting. So that might be a good way going forward in any way, aren't we? Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Good contribution. I see Barbara has indicated her agreement with the green check mark, and I am happy to continue in that mode. We can certainly change course on this if we find, you know, a couple of meetings down the road if it's not working, if I'm just missing too many calls or folks really feel like we need some additional backup. I'm certainly willing to revisit this question. But does anyone, if we don't have any strong feelings in the other direction, then I would propose that we just kind of move on with this approach, and then certainly leave the door open to revisit it if we find that it's not working. So then that raises the question of as far as our due diligence. I think that we should probably report back to the GNSO Council regarding this change, as I know that they will probably be looking for a status update on how all the various working groups are adjusting to Mikey's withdrawal, including the council itself. So I believe, Volker, you are our council liaison on this group, so is this something that you can bring back to our next meeting, which I believe is scheduled for early May?
Yes, sure. I don't think that should be a problem.
Or should
we have a? I don't think we have a council meeting before then, but we can probably do something on the council list.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Volker. And once again, I just want to emphasize to folks that I certainly will miss Mikey and appreciate his contribution, but certainly can empathize with being overcommitted. We will do our best to carry on without him, and we will certainly miss his charts. So with that said, we can perhaps close this issue and move on to agenda item number 3, which is a review of our meeting in Singapore. Just if memory serves, and I may lean on Lars a bit to fill in some of the details and provide some of the color, but if memory serves, we had a short meeting in Singapore. It was lightly attended, mostly working group members. At this meeting, we reiterated some of our draft recommendations that were presented to the council in the weekend sessions, and also highlighted some of those points for discussion that were fairly open questions. We did not have a lot of interaction. I believe there were discussion on a couple of points, but Lars, I wonder if you could, and we did also, I should mention, we did adjourn fairly early due to just the lack of attendance or issues involved. So, Lars, I wonder if you had any other specific items coming out of the Singapore meeting that you wanted to raise. I don't know that anything concrete or any specific action items were raised.
Thank you, James. This is Lars, for the record. No, I just wanted to, for those who were not be able to be in Singapore or were able to join remotely, just to clarify that it was, as you said, a very short meeting. Few people showed up. I think the consensus was that next time we'll go back to the usual 7:30 a.m. meeting time, so that people show up in greater numbers. That seems to be the case. I said that with a smile, obviously.
Yes.
No. And
well, we should move it to 6:30 in the morning so we can have even more turnout.
Absolutely. And you know, it's London time, so 6:30 in the morning, it's 7:30 my Brussels time anyway, so that's just good for me. I think the only other thing to add is that when we presented to the council on the weekend, is that the only issue, if my memory serves me correctly, that was brought up by council members was the issue of the extension of the statute of limitations that the group recommends to be extended from 6 months to a year. And a couple of councillors, I think Thomas Rickard notably, asked why was the case, why it was going to be a year and whether it shouldn't be even longer than that. But I think that's something that we can discuss.
Yes.
I've reached out to Thomas since to elaborate maybe on the reasoning a little bit, because that I think got lost, or he didn't elaborate very much on that. I think that's something we can talk about when we look at the review of public comments in a couple of weeks. And I think that's it. James.
Okay. Yes, and I do recall that from the weekend sessions. If memory serves, Thomas was questioning why 12 months for statute of limitation for disputed transfer. Why not 15 months? But I was not like you. I wasn't clear on the context for that comment. So perhaps in the interim, we can reach out to Thomas and see if he could submit something into the comment box. I think that would be helpful because I think we do need to capture that. I think that was, you know, again, emphasizing that it was a very brief meeting and it was not, despite the presence of food and caffeine, it was not that lively. So, Marika, I don't know if you had anything to add, anything from memory or from transcript, or is this aligning with your memory of our session in Singapore as well?
James, this is Lars. Marika, I think I'm not sure she's on the, she can hear us, but I'm not sure the audio is connected at the moment.
Okay, yes, she did post in the chat. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Marika, and that's... I think that's the general shared opinion all the way around. So anyone else who was in Singapore, or I know in the case of Barbara was our remote participant, did anyone else have any items that were raised in Singapore or perhaps that have occurred to you since returning from Singapore that you would like to address at this time? Otherwise, we can close the review segment of this meeting and move on to our work plan. Okay, the queue is clear. Thanks, everyone. And thanks to everyone who did turn up for the meeting in Singapore. I know that you know, those calendars can get very busy, and just holding that spot, I think, was invaluable. So I do appreciate that. So moving to the work plan, which Lars has posted in the Adobe chat, and sorry to Chris and others who are just on the phone, but we will work through this here. We have laid out the work plan between now and ICANN 50, which is in London in mid to late June. And the objective would be to, between now and that time, to review the public comments received, discuss the context of those comments, and modify, if necessary, the draft recommendations that we have put together. We would then, and just noting the schedule here, that the reply period for that comment period closes on April 25th, which is a week and a few days from now, and that we would then spend approximately 5 to 6 working groups reviewing the public comments, modifying the language of our draft recommendations and then performing a test, consensus test, on the level of support in this working group on each of those recommendations. And that's essentially the direction that we're going in until early June, at which point there is a publication deadline on June 2nd. So I'm reading this here. The final report does not have to go out for public comment, so this deadline is somewhat optional. That is the publication deadline for the London meeting. We have an additional meeting allocated on June 9th, which is, I believe, right about the time that everyone's wrapping things up and the mad scramble for London begins. And then on June 15th, we actually have a motion deadline for submitting motions to, for example, to make a motion to submit the final report to council. And that occurs on June 15th. And then the London meeting, including the weekend sessions, I believe, does someone have the calendar handy, would occur fairly shortly thereafter on June, I'm guessing the 22nd or something is when the weekend following the 15th, I believe.
Yeah, 21 of June is Saturday, and 22 is Sunday.
Thanks, Angie. So that's the 21 would be the weekend sessions for the council. So so that's the general plan. If I look at it, I think that we have ample sessions allocated to review public comments. I did note, checking this morning, that we had received two public comments to our initial report, one from a reseller turned registrar and another from the registry stakeholder group. Both are generally supportive of our initial recommendations so far, but had some questions, comments, or concerns about some of the specific details. And, of course, we're expecting that we may receive some additional comments between now and the end of the reply period, approximately 10 days or 11 days from now. So so that's the work plan. I think it is fairly doable. Again, very much dependent upon the number, the volume of comments that are received, and also the substance of the comments and whether they materially alter our recommendations. But if anyone has any thoughts or comments on this particular work plan, certainly it's not carved in stone. We can adjust as necessary if we get further down and we feel like we're just not going to make that London meeting. But I believe that it's there are ample opportunities to review and get the work done that we need to do so that the critical path does take us to the London deadline. So with that, we'll open a queue, see what anyone else wants to weigh in on that. What a quiet group this morning. It must have been Mikey that was the catalyst for all the comments, because it's just so quiet. But okay, so I guess the absence of objections would be an indication that we can go ahead and consider this tentatively adopted, Lars. So thank you again for updating this schedule, and maybe you can make a note that we'll revisit this in sometime towards the middle to the end of May. Is that acceptable?
Sorry, James, I was on mute. I put a green check mark in. Yes, it's absolutely
I just saw it. Thanks, Lars. Sorry about that. I'm a little slow on that myself. And actually, I was just checking my calendar because we do have a May 26th, we have allocated as a working group meeting, but that is a U.S. holiday. I think that there is in the U.K., there's a spring banking holiday coming up here. So the only other caution or asterisk I would attach to this work plan is that we've got a couple of holidays that we're going to start bumping up into. And I think, in particular, the U.S. holiday on the 26th would probably mean that we wouldn't have much of a turnout for that particular meeting. So I don't know if we want to preemptively strike that one, Lars. I can tell you I won't be there. it's just let's keep that in the back of our mind. So, okay, so let's move on then to – I'm sorry?
I said no problem. I'll bear that in mind.
Yeah, I don't I see Barbara's already opting out. A lot of folks, you know, they want to shed their winter clothes and go on vacation for the first time during that Memorial Day weekend. So, after this last winter, nobody blames us, hopefully. So let's see. Then if we could then move on to the next item on our agenda, which is to refine the use cases. And Lars, I don't know if you have those handy and you could load those into the Adobe room.
This is Lars. Yes, James. I'm just bringing it up right now.
Thank you. And while Lars is doing that, I would just like to position to this group. At some point along the way, I kind of lost the handle on where we were going with the use cases. And I'm looking maybe to Lars and to some of the others to help me. Were they meant to substantiate any particular recommendation? Were they meant to serve as an aid or a guide to understanding how the TDRP worked? Where were they? They were attached as an annex, I believe, to our report. So, Lars, maybe you could help us with some background.
Thank you, James. This is Lars. Yes, the use cases came out of the effort originally to modify the TDRP and open it up for the registrant to initiate the TDRP. And so the group realized after some discussion that a lot of these cases that, or the hypothetical cases that came up with, whereby the TDRP doesn't work under the current system and should maybe be open up to registrants, that in fact those are all issues that are inter-registrant transfer related. And so the idea was to draw up a list of use cases that are currently not covered by the TDRP, and then to see whether either the implementation of the working group IRTP Part C, the recommendation of that working group, will cover those, and if that is not the case, that then a new issue report should be drafted in order to see whether a new policy needs to develop to deal with these use cases.
Okay, thank you.
And obviously, these cases were originally, you know, Mikey put them all together and put them in this format, and the idea was that we would go through them during this period and see whether we leave them as is or whether they then need to be refined any further.
Thanks. Okay, thank you for that, Lars. So then I propose that we, for the next remainder of this call, and perhaps for the next call, while we are still awaiting the closure of the final public comment period, that we review these use cases and see if we still want to keep them, combine them, modify them, et cetera. So if that's acceptable to everyone, then let's dive in. And, we can start with page one. Looks like there are 20 pages of use cases. Is that correct, Lars?
I'm afraid so, although I have to say printing it to the PDF was not as straightforward as I hoped, because it was originally a Word document, and with the landscape format, it's not great. So it's a bit less than it looks, but yes, it's a longer list. But most of them, I think, should be straightforward and could be worked through, I believe.
Okay. So then hopefully we can get through them fairly quickly, and I apologize for the formatting, but it probably doesn't look this way in the final report. So the first one is a registrar is not authorizing a transfer out or is not providing an auth info code in a timely manner. The first column indicates that the existing policy covers this scenario. Then I believe, can you help me what the middle column means again? Who is this, a responsible party?
Yes, I believe it is.
Okay. And then the final column is the enforcement mechanism?
Yeah, it's also the enforcement mechanism and also the question of whether compliance or not has a pull on that as things stand, I believe.
Okay, so it's specific.
Yeah, absolutely. It's based on the feedback we received and the call that we have with Carlos Alvarez from Compliance, who's been moved on recently.
Okay.
I think that's what Mikey added down the last column.
All right. Okay, fair enough. And in this case, I think we indicate that the registrar and registrant are both parties that are involved in that. I don't know if that's correct. I think in this one it would be simply just registrars. I don't understand the registrant role in this first use case. But I agree with the final column that compliance has a role. You know, basically this is a clear-cut case of a registrar not meeting its obligations under the policy. So, second use case. A registrar is not participating in resolving an issue with a transfer. Several attempts have been made to engage by the other registrar, including a message to the emergency action contact, to no avail. Really, I'd like to clean this up and just essentially say registrar not responding to TIAC requests. Because, you know, a registrar is not obligated to just, you know, respond to casual inquiries regarding a transfer. We may think that that's poor form on their part, but, you know, it's not a matter of compliance. It is, however, a matter of compliance if they do not respond in a timely manner to TIAC requests. So, Lars, and to the working group, I think that this needs to be narrowed down and targeted a little bit better, and the statement needs to be essentially that a registrar is not responsive to TIAC requests regarding regarding an issue with a transfer. I see a green check mark from Barbara. I don't know if anyone else feels the same. If we make that change... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Lars.
Yeah, I just wanted to check, James, whether it's okay for you. I don't know how you want to proceed, because I've got the Word file open too. Whether it's okay that I capture this straight away and track changes and then send updates around to the group.
That sounds perfect. You know, I think that speed is of the essence here. And if that's the fastest way to keep everything organized, that'd be great. And I see a green check mark from Volker as well. So, okay, and I agree that all those other columns are correct. The third use case, registrar is not unlocking a domain name. I believe that everything looks correct there. I don't know if it's... Yeah, I think that that's fine. I think that we have some specific language in the existing policies about either unlocking or providing a means for the registrant to unlock the name. Okay, page two, or allow the registrant to unlock the name. There we are. The next use case follows on with that. Oh, it got much larger. Thank you, Lars. Okay. So the next use case where the forms of authorization are not – I'm sorry, Lars, one other change. Could we number these so that we can refer to the use cases by number? I think that's going to help us.
Yeah, we'll do that. I'm sorry, I didn't clean this up before the call. I just took them out of the report. I hadn't looked in a while because it was Mike who started them off, and I will clean them up for next week. I apologize.
No problem. That's what we're doing now. So this is – I think for some of us, this is our first time we're actually spending some quality time with these use cases. So. Next item, where FOAs are not sent to the two transfer contacts. Existing policy applies. I think this is correct. Next use case, the third one on this page. The administrative contact authorizes the transfer, but the registrant is challenging it. ICANN policy does not apply, but an inter-registrar dispute transfer can be made available. I'm not sure I'm completely on board with this. I believe, as we learned in the first IRTP, that the policy is very clear that the registrant, you know, in case of a dispute between the registrant and the transfer, the administrative contact, the registrant prevails. I think that we discussed how do we find that out, but in general, I think this is covered. Barbara, go ahead, please.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. Hopefully the volume's okay. I'm using my mic on my Adobe connection. So I agree with you, James. I do think it is covered by the policy, at least the transfer dispute policy portion of the policy. It does state very clearly that the registrant can trump administrative contact. And I also agree that I think that the only way we do really know that is if a dispute's raised.
Okay, thank you. So I think that what we're saying here is that we should note that existing policy does apply as the previous use cases. I think there is an open question about how a registrant or a registry will become aware that the transfer was being challenged by the registrant. I think that the rest of it could be okay. I'm still reading the last column. Sorry, folks. The compliance may have a role as inter-registrant rules are defined. Actually, compliance may have a role now under the existing policy if it can be shown that the registrar very clearly had conflicting instructions from the registrant, the administrative contact, and instead did not go with the wishes of the registrant. So I think that I'd be more comfortable using the language from previous use cases, compliance has a role under existing policy. And I'm not sure about the word clearly or may. I think that we could probably remove those in all cases and be a little more comfortable and tighten up this language a little bit. I get agreements from Lars. Okay, thank you. So moving to the fourth use case on this page, when an auth info code is sent to the wrong Whois contact to the account holder, that sometimes is not listed in Whois. Existing policy applies between registrars, and compliance has a role. I agree with that. That's a registrar that doesn't understand how the process works. Okay. Moving on to page 3. Two registrants are disputing the right to a domain name after an inter-registrar transfer. Registrars went through the process and have no further information to add. ICANN policy does not apply. That is correct. I think that if it is essentially a dispute over control or who is the legitimate registrant, that is, we get into a gray area here. If this is a general, I guess where I have trouble with this use case is the term two registrants. There is only one registrant at any given time on a domain name. There could be two parties claiming to be the registrant. So in that case, we would say two entities are disputing the right to be the registrant of a domain name, or two registrant claimants are disputing the right to a domain name. I think that I would be happier with that kind of language as opposed to saying two registrants. I think it's very clear that a domain name can have one and only one registrant. I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts on that. I don't know. Sometimes, please don't let me go off on a limb here, folks, and just start rewriting this. But it seems to me that sentence is just factually incorrect. Okay. Well, I'm taking silence as agreement and moving to the next column here. That this is. This is correct. There is no policy currently governing this, and that this is entirely between registrants. I would say entirely between parties, between private parties claiming, or registrant claimants, if that's a term. I would say correct. Compliance does not have a role in resolving or adjudicating those disputes. I think we're going to see this issue throughout the use cases, Lars, so let's just make a note here that whenever we see something referring to two registrants or both registrants, we should confirm that means some sort of claimants or parties or would-be registrants or aspiring registrants or whatever. But we'll just move on from here. Both registrants were acknowledged at some point in time as being registrants, as being the registrant. How about that? Both parties. Both names have appeared in Whois, but now disagree as to who the true registrant is. I'm having a hard time making a distinction between this use case and the one above it. Perhaps they could be combined. That's maybe we can mark those two, Lars, and come back to them. But I think that is a different way of or a different wrinkle stating the same thing as this was said above. I see Barbara agrees they could be combined, and Volker has his hand raised. Go ahead, Volker.
The only situation where I could see that there would be a difference between the two is when one party has never been in the Whois. For example, when you have a company that's providing web hosting services and puts itself into the Whois, but the beneficial owner of the domain name has always been the third party, then the transfer occurred, and that would be a case where the first one applies, but not the second. But I'm not even sure if that's something that we should cover here.
Well, it's a good point to identify it because it is, as we discussed, it is a common occurrence. But I think that is an important distinction. However, we do arrive at the same answer. So maybe we can structure the description of the use case to account for both both scenarios, where we could say something like two parties who may or may not have appeared in the public Whois are disputing the right to be the registrant of a domain name immediately prior to or following a transfer, something like that. And I think that would be a sort of I draw a line around both of those cases.
Well, the second one, now that I look at it, also has the distinction of not including any transfer of registrars. So the second one is framed currently as regardless of whether there has been an inter-registrar transfer. So it could still be with the same registrar, essentially, in the second scenario.
Oh, I see. Okay. So the first one is really about claimants. Yeah, I hate for this to turn into, we were trying to combine them into one, I hate for it to turn into four, but it does feel like we're having a conversation about, whether there is or is not a transfer and whether or not both parties ever appeared as the registrant. I think those are, I'm picturing a 2x2 matrix or truth table on that. And, so instead, how about this? I propose that we leave the first one as two parties are disputing the rights to be the registrant of a domain name. Either before or immediately following an inter-registrar or inter-registrant transfer. And then the second use case would be similar, but would not involve the inter-registrar transfer. No transfer would be required. We may have to come back to that one, Lars. Sorry. This one, I think, is getting a little tricky. Let's flag that one and then maybe circle back to it. The next one is administrative and registrant contacts are spread across two parts of an organization. The disagreement between them and the validity of a transfer. I don't see how this one is materially different from, if we scroll back up to the third use case, where basically the administrative contact and the registrant contact are disagreeing, and the policy does apply. Now, I think this one does at least indicate that there is an inter-registrar transfer or an inter-registrant transfer, and I think both of those are covered under ICANN policy, although IRTPC is yet to be fully implemented. So my recommendation would be that we change the that we change this to green and say essentially that existing policy, I'm sorry, the green or the orange and say existing policy applies, and that there would be a compliance would have a role to enforce this under the existing policy. That would be my recommendation for this. The color coding is also throwing me off just a little bit here. So, okay, different contacts or different departments within an organization have conflicts. ICANN policy does not apply. I agree. It would depend upon whether or not any of those contacts are listed in who is as the administrative contact or the registrant. Otherwise, you know, and if so, then it would be, I believe, swept up under one of the use cases that we identified earlier, not the one immediately above it. Fairly silent from the group here. I guess that means we're all thinking alike, or we don't care. So I'm going to assume that we're all on the same page then. Next one, and now I'm finally turned over to page 4 here. A registrant claimant approaches a registrar claiming that they are the registrant rather than the proxy service provider who the domain name is registered. Well, then I think that this really falls into a similar similar bucket as one of the previous cases where we identified two private parties disputing the right to be the registrant of a domain name. I think the wrinkle of including a proxy service provider is, from a policy perspective, is not not material. Volker, please go ahead.
Yeah, I would suggest that on this question, we really kick the can down to the Privacy Proxy Accreditation project and not deal with this on this level. Privacy Proxy and proxy services and the obligations thereof, I think, are best dealt with in that circumstance, and not really a question of transfer of registrants and registrars. Just because they are already dealing with the subject matter at hand makes it easier to delegate or try to push that to another level. I think dealing with that at this level here in this group would probably go too deep into the field that the others are dealing with already.
I think you're correct, Volker, and I think that in general, just for a question of elegance, is that this particular process, the transfer process, should be agnostic as to whether or not one of the registrants is the proxy service provider, and treat them, you know, as functionally equivalent to any other registrant or registrant claimant. And then you're correct, the rules and requirements that are being developed for proxy service providers may or may not want to put special best practices or contractual obligations around this here, but I think that we probably should not be building those special cases, baking them into this this policy. Does anyone feel strongly that that's not the case? I mean, as a very, you know, marginal software developer years ago, it just feels to me that that's a more elegant process and not trying to overload transfers by building in contingencies for proxy services, but just being agnostic as to what kind of registrant we're talking about. Marika is in the chat. Okay, I'll read it because I think she still has audio. It is a specific question that may come up in PPSAI tomorrow, as the working group has specifically asked to consider how transfers and renewals factor into privacy proxy accreditation. That is correct, and I can tell you as a member of that group that I can report to this group that that was the topic that was raised in our last PPSAI call, and that it was discussed I think there was a fairly solid discussion on that about how proxy and privacy services currently deal with these questions. Many of them, I think, simply just use their position as the registrant to NAC transfer requests until that service is canceled. So, and James will be presenting on the IRTP, so this is an ideal position to relay a scenario. I should probably prepare something for that, then. Thank you for the reminder, Rika. Because I think that meeting is tomorrow. Okay, so does anyone feel strongly that we should fold this into this working group, or I think this use case is best dealt with as if it were any other registrant or registrant claimant. And I think that Mikey, when he was putting these together, acknowledged that by leaving some of these edge cases down here blank. Now, moving then to going a little bit further down to the bottom of page 4, there's a note here that a website designer registers a domain name under their name on behalf of a customer for whom they build a website. They're challenged by their customer who claims to be the registrant but has never appeared in any Whois record at any time. ICANN policy does not apply, but an inter-registrant dispute process could be made available. I disagree with that first box. I agree that ICANN policy does not apply. I don't know that there is any dispute resolution process that could be created or implemented that would encompass this. This use case. I'm opening up the floor here to folks. I think that if we develop a dispute process where an individual or an entity can claim to be the registrant, I think that that is the camel's nose poking into the tent here a little bit and dragging ICANN into adjudicating disputes between private parties, and I think that that is a very slippery slope. Volker, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, James. Actually, I've dealt with a couple of these things in the recent past myself, and I always feel that it's not our role to decide what the contract between the two parties says. And it may be that they had, in their original agreement, agreed that the website designer would remain owner of the website for a certain amount of time, and now the beneficial owner of the website is trying to get out of an agreement. So this is something that there's more layers there that we cannot know as a registrar or even as ICANN, and therefore I don't think that this should apply. The Whois record should be at least to some point the basis for which we operate, and if someone has never been in the Whois, well, he should have checked that earlier.
So, just weighing in as a registrar, I tend to agree with your assessment, Volker. This is a rabbit hole that I don't think we, and I say we as an ICANN, we as a community, and we as registrars should be interested in going down. As you mentioned, there is some sort of an arrangement. We can only hope it was a written contract between a website builder and their customer. There may not have been. It could have been a verbal. It could have been a handshake. They could have been cousins. It's really, the varieties start to multiply fairly quickly. I think that, the legal-minded folks on the call might realize that we might be going down different, we might be traipsing into minefields regarding, like, work-for-hire type issues, and when something is a work for hire versus when something has some kind of an ownership component to it. I think that all of those red flags are screaming at us that this does not belong under the ICANN umbrella. So but I'm open to I would welcome anyone who wants to contribute or weigh in, either in support or in opposition to that idea.
Chris here.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard this one. I mean, this is a very common case, isn't it? And I've heard somebody said to me once when we discussed it, maybe on this group, oh, yes, that's equity law. And of course it isn't. I think we're right that we don't want to go down there. But it does occur to me, I wonder if there is a text or part of an FAQ on the ICAM website, maybe in the compliance section or somewhere, that if it was happening to me, our comment would almost be not part of the work group's activity, not part of ICAM's responsibility, but please refer here. And then there's an explanation, really, to say if you're not the registered name holder and you believe you really are the owner of the domain, then make sure you've got a good equity law contract between you and the person that is the registered name holder. It would just be a good cross-check to see if that information does exist, that statement or that help sheet does exist anywhere. That was my comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. I think that's an interesting component here as we talk about ICANN's role in developing and disseminating educational materials. I think making sure that people are, or websites, customers of web developers are aware that they should exist somewhere in Whois in order to have a legitimate claim to be the registrant of a domain name is important. So I'm not sure where we can kind of squeeze that in. Maybe there was an earlier recommendation about ICANN centralizing some of these resources. So maybe, Lars, if we can just capture this as an action to look and see if there's a place to make this recommendation. I might add that, you know, if you don't have a contract, you know, with your website developer, you know, the recommendation would be just that if you do not appear in Whois, you will have no rights to the domain name. You know, if you believe you should appear in Whois, contact your service provider, in this case the website designer. We could go even a bit further, as we have acknowledged this is very common, and I can tell you besides this and the disgruntled employee, this is probably one of the more common cases of disputed transfers or disputed ownerships is one possibility is as we're have other areas of the ICANN community are examining possible replacements for Whois, but do we want to consider that, you know, the idea of an administrative contact and a registrant contact are being used properly? You know, do website designers need to be similar to making registrants aware, do we need to make website designers aware that they should, as a best practice, list their customer's name as what? Administrative contact, billing contact, you know, something. You know, I most of them won't, but I mean, at least it might do some good to publicize that. Should there be a separate contact? Should there be a beneficial user contact in the new replacement Whois directory service that lists the ultimate responsible party? Would that be abused by spammers or bad people, you know, saying, oh, no, I was just doing this for this invisible client that you'll never be able to find? You know, I think it's an open question, I think, but listing it here as I think that we are all on the same page, that this is very much outside the scope of ICANN policy. However, there could be opportunities for ICANN to develop and disseminate some registrant educational advice on this area. So anyone else want to weigh in on this before we move on? And I notice we're getting towards the top of the hour, so we may have to put a bookmark here and start here next
James
week.
James, this is Angie Graves.
Angie, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say I do think it's a very important educational item, and I do think that the community could afford to be more aware of some of the things that they need to do. This is one on a list of many that responsible domain owners need to abide by. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Angie. And I believe we have a green check mark from Lars that we will take this and try to find a way to neatly and succinctly insert this in recommendation into our report when we talk about educational materials. And maybe, you know, it's not just on ICANN. Maybe it's something that can be spread around to other aspects of the community, into UC and the commercial users and registrars and as well might have a role to play in building some customer awareness around this issue. So, but I think we've captured that.
Angie, I want to say one more thing. Sorry.
Yes, Angie, please. Go ahead.
I've been working with ISOC, and I think they would definitely be interested if there were materials available in linking to them or posting them at the ISOC site. Thanks.
Excellent. Thanks, Angie. And Lars, can you tack that onto this action item?
No problem.
Okay. Green check mark. Thank you. 3 minutes before the top of the hour, so let's pause our review here. Hopefully this is helpful. I think that we're making progress through these use cases. I think that they, as an annex, will help provide some of the color to our report. I do think, however, some of the language and formatting needs to be cleaned up, and that's just me editorializing, so if anyone else has any thoughts or would welcome them on that. Next meeting will be 1 week from today, same time, on Tuesday the 21st. I did note, did someone, I think in the chat, was it? Okay, right. That is, next week is Easter Monday, which I think is a holiday in some parts of Europe. Can we use this system to the green and red to see is anyone going to plan to attend or will know that they will not be able to attend next week? Can you give me a red if you know you'll be absent and a green if you know you'll be present so we can get an idea?
This is Angie Graves again. I'm not in the chat. I'm available. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Angie. Chris?
Green, yes.
Thank you. Okay. So we've got a couple green. We've got red from Volker. We've got two greens on the phone. I'm assuming everyone else is just taking a nap. That was a joke. Let's meet as planned next week, and we'll see if we can't reach a quorum. And by quorum, not only in terms of the number, just raw headcount of people attending, but we want to make sure that we have some balanced cross-community representation as well. So let's proceed with next week's meeting as scheduled, and we will take stock at that time and determine if we should proceed. And the agenda will be, in the rough case, to just proceed beginning on page 5 of our use cases. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for attending. I think we had a productive meeting. We covered a number of items on our agenda, and we are well on our way of reviewing the use cases. If your constituency or stakeholder group has not yet submitted a comment, please encourage them to do so, either as a group or on behalf of individual members. And with that, I will close the call. Thanks, everyone.